The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
On the night of the 22nd of December 1996, a decades-long mystery began when a French national, Sophie Toscan de Plantier, was murdered in Tourmore near Skull in West Cork. Veteran journalist Senan Maloney is the author of a new book entitled Sophie, The Final Verdict. Now, Senan was the first national correspondent on the scene of Sophie's murder, where he had arranged to meet a local freelance journalist hired by the Star. That man's name was Owen, or Ian Bailey. But 7 weeks later, after the pair had met, Ian Bailey was arrested as a prime suspect, but was never ultimately charged. The 2024 death of Ian Bailey reopened the case for Senan Maloney, who's written this new book, Sophie, The Final Verdict. It's an analysis from a journalistic point of view of what was seen and in his own written and reported words, those of Ian Bailey. And it amounts to what might be described as an anecdotal case for the prosecution. The author is convinced that Ian Bailey indeed was the murderer of Sophie Toscan de Plantier. Senan Maloney, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat. How are you doing?
Okay, you are convinced that Ian Bailey was the perpetrator. But before we talk about that, just give us the bones of the crime itself.
Oh, a dreadful crime. A young visitor to Ireland, a young mother, Sophie Toscan de Plantier, flew into her holiday home in Cork on Friday the 19th of December. And a few days later, she is dead. She wanted to spend some time working alone on scripts because she was a film producer married to the head of Unifrance, the French film conglomerate. And instead of a Cade Mila Falch in Ireland, she got a dead Mila Falch. Her coffin was loaded into the belly of an airplane and sent home as air cargo on Christmas Day.
Now, when we think of, you know, an expat's home in West Cork, we think luxury. This was not. This was a fairly primitive kind of cottage with damp in the upper bedroom.
Yeah, it was a very a lot of frontage to the cottage in Dunmanis West, in Tourmore, in West Cork, on that Mizzen Peninsula, which is a tiny little sliver of land, really very remote. Although it had this massive frontage, it was quite narrow inside, and there were and basically it was an open plan with a sort of a stairs leading upstairs and a couple of bedrooms. One of which was flashed by the beam of the Fastnet light every night,
and which Sophie she found very reassuring that there was this beacon watching her, as it were,
a big security light.
Mm. Yeah. Now the manner of her death: she was bludgeoned to death.
Yes, she was bludgeoned to death. I'm afraid her head was nearly obliterated. John Harbison could see brain matter when he got to the scene. Eventually, it was a very, very severe case. It was the most barbaric killing, I would contend, or one of the most barbaric of the last 50 years in Ireland. And that alone screams out for justice to be done for the poor woman and for her family.
And the only place that justice was done for her family was in France, where Ian Bailey was in absentia convicted.
Ian Bailey was convicted in 2019. Some Irish witnesses flew over. There were three French judges. Ian Bailey and his solicitor, Frank Buttermer, had tried to block the trial taking place at all. And it resulted in Ian Bailey being convicted and sentenced to 25 years in prison. So what I'm doing, because I'm conscious that people have seen flickering parts of this light show over the years, I'm putting all the evidence together.
I mean, there was the Netflix documentary and the Sky documentary, both taking kind of alternative sides to the story. Now, when I read the book, I was taken by the very first chapter when you first encounter the stringer for the Star, Ian, or as he liked to fashion himself, Owen, to sound more Irish, Owen Bailey. You met him and you're in a photographer's van. You're consigned to the back of it, and the large, rather tall Ian Bailey gets your passenger seat.
That's right.
And he seemed to have knowledge aforethought, really, of everything that happened.
Well, I had doubts about this stringer we were going to meet because it was all very ill-defined. We got to a slope outside Skull, and then I saw this gaunt figure against the sky. And I remember vividly turning to the photographer who was driving and saying, "I know West Cork is ridiculous, but is bohemian, but this is ridiculous. This figure here, you know." And so we rolled down the window and said, "Ian Bailey," because we'd been told his name. And he said, "He," and he leaned in and gave us the
that
eye.
That was his reply. "Are you Ian Bailey?"
Yeah, rather grandly.
Yeah.
And he was very dishevelled at the same time. He was like King Lear out on the blasted heath, if you like. You know what I mean? I describe him as looking like he was dragged through a bush backwards. Mm. But I got in the back then, and I was looking at the back of his head with his long hair down to his collar. And despite my dubious impression of him at first, he suddenly started reeling off extraordinary details of the crime as we were driving there. He was going to guide us, and he spoke about the lights going off at particular times, about the body having its boots on, one laced up and one still loose.
Now, at this point, the guards, once the neighbour had discovered Sophie's body, because they had a shared driveway, they called the guards in shock. The guards came, and even though they were the local guards, not the National Murder Squad, I think they cordoned off the area. So no one had access to the body.
Yes, and the cordon was holding you back about 130 yards, and you couldn't see the turn, the right-hand turn into the drive, which was also screened by huge brambles.
So two possibilities. One is that Ian Bailey had come upon this earlier himself and therefore noted some detail, or he was there when it happened.
Or he had a very good senior Garda officer who was trusting him completely and giving him details that were not going to headquarters, because he had this almost immediately, this stuff at his
Everything at his fingertips. That he told you in that early meeting in the van, did that turn out to be true?
No, because one of the most extraordinary details he suggested was that Sophie had sat down and drunk convivial wine with her killer before something went wrong, and she fled from the house and he bolted from it as well and pursued her and then did her to death. And he was basing this on two upturned wine glasses on Sophie's draining board. And I filed this detail because it was extraordinary. I was suggesting that there would be fingerprint tests on the glasses, as there were indeed. But everything in that house was found to have Sophie's prints. And by the way, Sophie also used the wine glasses for water. She would have, I've seen photographs from inside the house and at picnics and so on, where they're using those wine glasses for water.
But in terms of his description of the way the body was to be found, was all of that accurate as it turned out?
Very much so. And quite an extraordinary level of detail. I promise you, you said I was a veteran reporter at the beginning, and I was very experienced in crime at that stage. I'd interviewed a lot of killers. And I've never had a better fill, as we call it in the trade, an infill of the details, either before or since.
So you were dying to find out who his Garda contact was, who'd given him such forensic detail of the crime scene.
I was both jealous and humiliated. I felt like whatever thought I might have had of having a Fleet Street career was gone when this was a regional stringer could be this good. So he put me in the halfpenny place. But then I was thrilled when he asked me. He said, come on, you're the crime journalist. You tell me, what do you think? And so I said, well, look, this is a local killer, because and the guards will have this wrapped up in 2 weeks. And he said, what do you mean? He was taken aback. And I said, here we have a situation where a person has been overkilled. You know, dozens of blows with the concrete block were inflicted after she was dead. That's rage. So it was a rage killing. It was not premeditated. Secondly, the killer used what was to hand, a concrete block that had been ripped away from a pump house across the drive and a large stone that was torn out of one of the dry stone walls. So he was using weapons of opportunity. Again, that says no premeditation. Thirdly, this place is impossibly hard to find. I've driven the uncle and family members and got lost myself trying to find the house after, because it's in a little cleft of the mountains.
So you arrive at the scene, you're kept 120 yards away, and you want Bailey to come down with you to chat to the guard,
exactly,
since he was so well connected, and get you closer or whatever.
Correct.
What happened?
We had bought up Ian Bailey, so he was my fixer for the day.
Yeah.
So when he says stop here, I thought he was doing it for purposes of a nice camera angle for my photographer, Martin Marr. So Martin jumps out and he's getting his cameras together. And indeed, it was a nice view down to the scene from this crest. And as he's shooting off a few frames, I say to Bailey, come on, come on, let's go.
Yeah.
Come on, chop, chop. You know, you're to come down here and introduce me to these guards, because, you know, all you have to do is say, ah, this young fella is all right. You know, he'll be just humour him, answer a few old questions. You know? Because I was so convinced he was so well got with the guards that a few words from him would act as an open sesame for me to interview and get a few more details. But instead, he goes, "Oh no! You're on your own, and I've done all I can from here." And as I was starting to remonstrate with him, my photographer was saying, "Come on, we haven't got the light," and so on,
because
the light
was
fading
late,
fast.
Yeah,
we'd driven down from Dublin. It was the winter, deep December and we didn't have motorways or anything like that. So my Sherpa was heading off and I had no opportunity, nothing to do except follow him. But when we got to the guards, the uniforms came up straight away and I was trying to, I introduced myself, showed press card, nice friendly questions such as you're giving me today. And they said, I'm sorry, Garda press office, please. Garda. They were very obdurate.
They were not going to be shifted. They referred you straight away to the Garda press office. They were telling you nothing.
Yeah, and I was trying to insinuate myself and inveigle him into giving a few
and
details.
At what point then did you begin to suspect that Ian Bailey might be in the frame for this?
I have to tell you, Pat, I had my doubts. My wife tells me that I came back and expressed doubts, but in my own mind now, it was the arrest of Ian Bailey that really did it for me, you know. But as soon as I heard from my news desk that he had been arrested, the scales dropped from my eyes because really, he ticked all the boxes for a potential suspect. Let's put it that way. Yeah. I mean, he was a local, as I told him the killer would be. He was powerfully built. I mean, this man was picking up, it was definitely a man who killed her, he was picking up a concrete block that weighs 12 pounds and pounding it down on her head.
Now, when you look at all the other things that Ian Bailey did in terms of his journalistic contributions, it would appear he was very anxious to point the finger at some mystery visiting Frenchman, perhaps. Perhaps someone like a contract killer or a lover. All of these things were part of his offerings.
Yes, can't you just imagine the contract killing killer putting that concrete block into the overhead bin at Charles de Gaulle Airport because he'd be needing it later on. I find that an extraordinary suggestion. Also, to go to the to go to such a locality, you'd stick out like a sore thumb. The French contract killer would be obliged to stop at every turn and ask for directions. No. But he was blaming other people. He even blamed Alfie Lyons, who's now dead, and who was his cannabis supplier, who lived behind Sophie and had a conviction for growing cannabis. So that was his friend. He blamed a mentally handicapped near neighbour. He blamed a German man who had fits of depression and who went home and drove a Jeep off a cliff in Germany shortly after. And the guards were, at that point, the guards came out and said, this is very hurtful to the man's family. He's not a suspect. But Bailey was putting all these suggestions around.
Now, he was arrested and therefore nominated as a suspect. And years later, he always saw himself and acknowledged himself to be the prime suspect in the absence of anybody else. But with all the forensic information and the post-mortem and all that became available to the Gardaí, and they sent a file to the DPP, the DPP said no.
Yeah, one of the extraordinary things, you mentioned the forensics. One of the things that Bailey reported on St. Stephen's Day, very shortly after the murder, was that Sophie had not been sexually assaulted. And in fact, the swabs had gone away. He knew more than the pathologist. John Harrison didn't know that. He had sent away swabs for testing and they would take weeks to come back. In fact, 2 weeks after Bailey reported that she was not sexually assaulted, in print, the Irish Times ran a story saying, you know, forensic swabs test results.
Well, that's maybe a 50-50 call that Bailey guesses.
Yeah.
You know, that would not be proof positive. But the question of whether or not he knew Sophie Toscan de Plante or was in any way acquainted with her, even visually... I interviewed him, and you featured in the book in 1997, 4 days after I think he had been released.
He'd just been released, yeah. And I had done an interview with him.
Yeah, and he said, when I asked him, did you know Sophie? He said, no, absolutely not.
Yeah, and subsequently at a libel case that he took against 8 newspapers and comprehensively lost, although there were 2 minor findings against 2 tabloids, Bailey was caught out in that because his neighbour, Alfie, who had employed Bailey for 4 days to do gardening work during a week when Sophie was staying at the house, he said under oath that he was at least 90% sure that he had introduced Bailey to Sophie, at least 90%. So that's pretty comprehensive. And furthermore, Bailey had a strange habit of writing things into his journals and his black diaries, and he hid a lot of stuff in T-line shorthand, which is a very obscure form of shorthand. The Gardaí got this T-line translated by somebody in the north of Ireland, and there were references to the introduction. So he had practically admitted in his own hand in T-line shorthand that he had been introduced to Sophie by Alfie. And in fact, there are many allegations that he did in fact know her and knew enough about her to go up there that night and to see what he could get as he accused somebody else.
And there were all sorts of things about the timeline of his movements and whether or not he was down in the studio having left the bed, which he shared with Jules Thomas, and whether or not he was there the whole night or whether he'd gone walkabout. All of these details. But can you understand the DPP's concern that there just wasn't enough to ensure a conviction?
Well, I can't understand it really, because and I go into a little bit of detail in this book, but not too much, because I want to put all what people saw and heard, the witnesses from West Cork, to tease out the detail. People have to understand that the DPP is not one single overarching sagacious person.
It's an office full of people,
where they dole out the files to people. And this file went to a particular person who later sued the DPP's office over non-promotion, if you like. And I think that person wouldn't, you know, zealous would be probably the most charitable way to interpret it, in terms of looking at every individual piece of evidence and saying, is this beyond all reasonable doubt? And that person was, instead of running circumstantial cases.
Well, what do you make of the Taoiseach's contention that Ian Bailey should have faced a jury of his peers?
Well, I'm very glad of it, because the Taoiseach, like yourself, has read the book. So the book is putting the evidence before the people for the first time. As it says on the front cover, with a quote from Jean-Pierre Gazot, he says, this is the book, Sophie, the final verdict, that puts all the evidence before the people. So I think that's what's been missing from this. And I have no particular axe to grind, except that I'm a journalist who was there, who saw the case close up. And I feel a certain need to let people know what the facts are, what is the case against Ian Bailey. Let them read, Sophie, the final verdict and make up their own
including
minds.
Including his own admissions, or whether these were being ironic or sarcastic to a number of people, that he had actually done it.
Yeah, over and over and over again, including one 14-year-old boy when he used foul language and said, I went up there and bashed her brains in. And then a weepy confession to two neighbours on a New Year's Eve.
There's the whole saga, which I won't go into now, Marie Farrell and her testimony withdrawn and reiterated and so on and so forth. It's a tortuous tale. But I think what you've done with this book is to invite everyone to read it all.
Yeah, and isn't that fair? Because this is the prosecution case, if you like. There's plenty of other evidence, grey matter, that would not get into any court. But we're not dealing with a court anymore. We're dealing with everyday, ordinary, lived reality. And it seems to me an absolute scandal, sweeping Ian Bailey away from all this. This goes back to the fact that a woman named Sophie, a guest in our country, a young mother, was brutally murdered, and Ireland failed to bring a charge against anyone.
Well, the book is called Sophie, the Final Verdict. It's published by Hachette Books Ireland, available everywhere. And its author, Senan Maloney. Senan, thank you very much for joining us in the studio.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.